Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm in Sweden, in Stockholm.
I'm in the office of
Professor Emeritus, yep. Stefan Lestadius. And he's written a book which, the Swedish title of which translates as Climate and Welfare. We'll come back in detail to the book, but we'll start with just a quick overview of that. What's it about?
The book starts where climate research ends, so to say. If you take climate change seriously, you also have to discuss how to transform society. That means not only transforming industry, but also transforming life in society so that you can keep the welfare. I mean, Sweden and Northern Europe is assumed to be a welfare region in the world, and the challenge is to keep this welfare system while transforming in adaption and mitigating climate change.
Fantastic. We're certainly going to come back to that, but let's go back as far as we can. Where did you grow up?
In Umeå, in northern part of Sweden, 800 kilometers north of Stockholm, where we are sitting now.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
Originally, I wanted to become an engineer, and now I'm just finished working at the Technical University, but there was a long road to this. I started very much working in economics, which is my basic degree in economics and in social science. And I was also very broadly interested in social change. And so when it came to climate change, I think I managed to integrate my technical and industrial interest with my interest in social change, and especially to keep a welfare model, so to say.
What led you to a first degree in economics?
Really, I don't remember that. But I remember what led me to become interested in environmental problems and sustainability. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was when I went to college, I read this Silent Spring book by Rachel Carson, I read it very early, and I was very young, and I was really impressed by this that book. And I think many of my generation friends, also at this university, that was the first step into sustainability. And later on, I was working a little with future studies for the government, and I was also reading the book Limits to Growth, with a study on 1973, I think. That was a book which was widely discussed all over the world, and it was heavily criticized, not the least by economists, but also by people who thought that this book was something which would tell the rest of the world that now, when the northern part of the world have got their lifestyle, there is no time, there is no space for the others to catch up. I think that was a wrong conclusion, and I think the Limits to Growth book was got too bad reputation, and many of their forecasts or discussions by then have turned out to be relatively true now. So I think it's highly relevant to upgrade that book when you discuss climate change questions now.
So you became an industrial economist, is that how you describe yourself?
Yeah, that is, my professorship is in industrial transformation, or was. I am retired since 1 year ago. Industrial transformation. That means not primarily focusing on how to manage industries, but how to analyze and understand the processes of industrial change. You may say that you add an element of economic and industrial history in it. You add an element of engineering and how new technologies develop, how you get closed in, or how do you get stuck in some technological paths and how you can try to escape from too narrow technological development into a new path. I mean, the classical illustration is that 100 years ago, there were in some parts of the world more electric cars than gasoline-driven cars. You may say that it could have, technological development could have taken another path in the early 20th century than it did, and then we would have had another situation now than we have. This kind of processes, how you get closed into some technologies and can get out of them, is part of the research we have had in our group here.
So what sorts of transformations are we talking about? Is this the whole Industrial Revolution, or are we looking at smaller details, the switch to the switch in mobility and so on?
I think revolutions is what we analyze ex post. When we are within them, we have to discuss transformations or changes of what we may label technological regimes. And now, of course, one of these is to transform away from the gasoline-driven car society. And it isn't enough just to put new fuel in old cars. It is, you cannot survive with the combustion engine. We're just putting ethanol in it. There wouldn't be that much biomass in the world. You have to search for new technological solutions, which isn't only, it also will include a dramatic reduction of the use of the personal car, even if you can run many of them with electricity. That is these kind of changes. Whether this becomes an industrial revolution, that is a question for the historians of the future. But I think the energy transformation now is huge. I sometimes talk about it as, especially in the political discussion in Sweden, and I suppose that is the case in your home country also, is that something of an elephant in the room. It is there. You know it is there, but it is so large, so huge, so dramatic, so challenging that you really don't want to talk about it. You don't want to talk about it. What do we have to do if we take climate change seriously? And I try to do that. And I also try to show that it is possible to change.
How closely coupled are industrial transformations and the associated social change?
I think we can say it like this. You have to, not least in Northern Europe, we have developed a welfare state. We will call it a process of modernity. The people believe that they have got all the welfare, all their technology, all their cars, all their living standards, that are part of modernity and welfare. And you will not convince people to leave all that to go into a Stone Age economy just to preserve the climate. So you have to show that instead of, you have to leave the man as, how to say, master of nature. It has been, historically has been the indication of modernity, historically, towards going into a more circular system which will provide a similar or comparable standard of living, although within the framework of a circular economy or a sustainable system. That is the challenge. It is a challenge for politicians. Otherwise, you will not get people accepting your policies. And I think we have a huge challenge now. I mean, just to illustrate, all the pledges for the Paris negotiations in December this year, the International Energy Agency have made some calculations on them, and I trust their calculations, that if you take all the promises given, all the pledges given by the governments, that is far from enough to reach the 2 centigrades target. In fact, that will end up with the 3.5 centigrades in global temperature, which is far beyond what we can manage. So we must go still further, but that means also that we have to show people that it is possible without getting a decline in welfare. So I think it's closely interrelated. A welfare system on the one hand based on a new sustainability-based industrial system. And if you cannot show people this, you will not get acceptance for the policies. And I think it's a tough thing, but it is possible.
Before we talk about the solutions that you are proposing, is there an alternative industrial transformation where we go the other way? Where we, you said moving away from man as a master of nature. Could we not go the let's take control of this thing?
Yeah, you mean, I think this is continue on the old way of it. I think we have, that is a lot of, the standard reaction also among many of my colleagues here at this university, finding new technical solutions along the old, how we call it, linear way of industrialism. We have seen it. You have seen it in this geoengineering suggestions you find all over the world. The most prominent geoengineering we have, which is still alive, and very, that is, of course, carbon capture and sequestration. I think this is the classical thing. You start a system, for example, the combustion engine, you produce a lot of pollution in the atmosphere, carbon. And when you get too much in the atmosphere, you try to pump it underground. You have it in the nuclear industry. You have a lot of energy from the nuclear power, which was not the nuclear power the original innovators thought of in the 1940s. They thought of a clean nuclear power, which we still haven't seen. Now we produce a lot of waste. You have it on your backyard, and all the nuclear power stations have it on their backyards, and now you are discussing to put it underground. It's very similar to when you clean up in your home, you put it under the carpet. And I think that is a dead end. It has there are limits. And I think these limits have been more clear now, and in fact I'm based here more on, not on my own research, but our colleagues, of which some are located here in Stockholm, the groups around Johan Rockström and others at the Stockholm University. They are talking about planetary boundaries. This is a large research topic for the moment. They have identified more or less a dozen. But what you see here is that hitherto, historically, mankind hasn't been close to the capacity of the Earth to accommodate. We have been local pollution, you can fix it. Somewhat national pollution, rich countries can fix it. We have done it in Sweden. But globally, we are now moving on in area after area towards the planetary boundaries. And then it becomes a serious problem. You have it in water shortage. You have it in carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions. And you have it in other areas also. And you have secondary things, like you heard the other day, for example, that half of the, you know, the tremendous problem in the global oceans, half of many of the fossils and all the things have escaped just or vanished from the global oceans. So that is the problem. Is you could fix it 50 years ago, you could accommodate and fix the problems, but now moving to the planetary boundaries, the old linear solutions are not there anymore. You have to be more humble and look more to circular, to sustainable solutions. It's a new way of thinking, and that is important also for us working with industrial change. We can do it. It is possible.
It's hard for us to be humble because, as you point out, we've done things before.
Yeah.
We ended slavery. We flew.
Yeah.
We reached the moon.
Yeah.
So we're not very good at being humble, and we do have a history of solving things.
Yeah. I agree with you. But there are limits to what we can do. So if those climate researchers and working with earth science, like my colleagues up at Stockholm University, talking about the planetary boundaries, I think my contribution is accepting that and trying to analyze what are the consequences then for industrial and social transformation. Mm-hmm. That's my topic, and that's what I.
So the book. What's the? I can't read it, unfortunately. But what's the opening premise of the book?
The opening premise is first. This is a new challenge. It is possible, and it is necessary. It is both possible and necessary to combine this transformation with a welfare society. You can't get people to accept the transformation, promising them that everything will be worse, whether you continue on the long road on the one hand or whether you transform on the other. So you must find a path where you can promise that this is something which will make be sustainable for you, your children, and your grandchildren. The problem for the book is, of course, that it is very easy to say that in this globalized world, where climate change is a real global phenomenon, you can very rapidly fall back into a position of nothing of what I do personally in Sweden or what we do in Sweden matters because it is so small. So there is also a message in the book which I call the snowball effect. It is the demonstrator effect, showing that all over the world people are discussing these things. It means that somebody has to go ahead, and you have to find a way to go ahead. You can't fall back to the general equilibrium, probably economistic solution, that you cannot do anything, because if you do anything, there is always somebody who will take your position and profit from you, and you will be a loser. This is this kind of leakage effect. That is the discussion on reduce your competitiveness if you go ahead. So you have to show that it is possible to transform. In fact, you may increase your competitiveness, you may inspire actors in other countries, and you can always say that we take this action nationally, we sharpen the rules for the industry here. If there are some free riders outside in the world who will try to profit from it, taking our markets, we can always go back. So that means you can make some kind of game theory, take two steps forward, asking others to take another, show that they are also taking a step, and then you can continue. I talk about climate walk, this way of trying to convince other actors to go in the same direction. I think it is important, especially if you want to convince industry and politicians in Sweden, which is extremely dependent on international markets. We are one of the most globalized economies in the world, except those very small countries where everything goes through the country. Mm-hmm. But it is a medium-sized country, highly dependent on global trade and global investments. So we have to solve that problem. Yeah, that one. So, I mean, it is possible. And then, I have a message here in the book, and still more in the discussions afterwards since I published it, that to show that it is possible, you have to break down the enormous task into something which is, concrete and useful. So I have four dimensions of how it can be done. I can tell you.
Yes.
Yeah. The first is you have to, half of the reductions has to be performed before 2030. You don't have to solve all the global problems. Half of the reductions before 2030. That is the low-hanging fruits. The second half could be done before 2050. And the third half after that, before 2070 and 80. So we don't have to solve all the problems. That can be done over a period. The second thing is another. And that means half times half times half. That is roughly where we have to go. Mm-hmm. The second view is more, engineering focused. You should reduce activity level of the sum of the emission systems to half. For example, reduce car travel to half. That is the activity level. Second is efficiency. You improve efficiency twice, half the energy use of the system, which is used just half as much. And the third thing, you substitute half of the energy with the sustainable forms of energy. That is also three times half. The third dimension, similarly, is I contribute to half of the emissions. My children, and provide opportunities for my children to do the same, and they also provide opportunities for their children, my grandchildren, to do the same. Three times half. So it is possible to start. You don't have to do everything now. My fourth dimension is more economical, so to say. In fact, the first period, until 2030, you reduce the emissions, that could be a target, 4% per year. I mean, we can discuss productivity increases, we discuss inflation targets for the banks and things. We can, of course, have a reduction target, 4% per year, during the coming 15 years. That will be roughly half. The next period, between 2030 and 2050, you can also talk about a 4% reduction per year. That will give you another half. And you can do similarly after 2050 for the coming 20 years. So overall, what I'm talking about is a reduction target, 4% of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions per year. This is not, I mean, we have always discussed economic growth, we have discussed productivity and things like that. So of course, this is a very concrete target politicians can have. And you can, of course, fine-tune it every year. Now we are not living up to that, so we calibrate our political instruments a little to really convince people to reduce their use of combustion engines and fossil fuels and things like that. This is possible.
And you're talking about absolute levels of carbon.
Yeah.
So we're not doing anything like saying per capita or per GDP.
No, the discussion now to a large extent before Paris is related to just the energy efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the Chinese have promised, and I think also the Obama, but I'm not sure on that, but at least the Chinese have promised to improve energy efficiency and reduce the carbon intensity in the economy. But as long as you have a growth of a lot of percentage economic growth, the declining energy intensity is of no interest for nature.
No.
We agree on that.
Yes, exactly.
So, we're talking about absolute levels.
So, the order is important there. Like, if we go back to that first dimension, so we start with the low-hanging fruit. So that's... hang on, one second, one... reducing activity level first.
Yeah.
So, doing less things? Is that what that means?
Doing less of carbon-emitting processes. Mm. I don't suggest that you should reduce your activity level. You should reduce those activities which are carbon dioxide-emitting, like car travel. Mm-hmm. That means you could travel with other means. Let me add something. I think this is well known among all researchers in this area. It's and especially we can say in Sweden this is a minor problem. I know there are problems in other countries, but we know that the sunshine input into the globe is probably 10,000 times as much as we absorb and use. There is an enormous potential to use the energy input, to transform it to useful energy with wind power, solar, photovoltaics, and using hydro and things like that. there is an enormous potential. It is unequally distributed over the world, we know that, but there are many things which are unequally distributed over the world, like oil also. So of course there is an enormous potential. We have made some calculations in Sweden, but we could produce enormous amount of wind power. The Germans already do, the Danes do. We can do it in Sweden, we have an enormous country. We could contribute a lot to the energy vendor in Europe. We could contribute to reducing the coal-fired energy production systems in Poland. Of course, this is a political problem and it is an economic problem. But technically, it's possible and we can contribute to welfare in that way. But of course, then you have to solve the problem, take care of the transformation of the Polish coal mines and all that stuff. That is what we have to solve. But my basic message, it is possible, but it is very tough because time is running out.
Why that order? Why the activity efficiency substitution order?
Yeah, I don't say you have to take it in that order. You can make it parallel. You can make this parallel to your... It's just to show that you have three processes which you can have. Reduce car travel with... that car travel which is still there, make them more efficient. And those who are there more efficient, drive them with electricity. Maybe Teslas, but I don't think Tesla is the solution, the global solution to the climate change problem, although it's an interesting car.
It is a good idea, though, to reduce the... If you can reduce the activity, that's less stuff you have to come up with in terms of efficiency and...
Yeah.
And substitution.
Yeah. I mean, and you can go on a very concrete level on the car travels. If you have a lot of... I've made calculations on some buses... In Sweden, for example, just a small reduction of car travel in Sweden will have an increase the demand for public transport in Sweden to the double. That is the same all over Europe, in fact. If all of 80% of personal transport now is made by car, if you keep the same transport level but reduce the car share from 80 to 60%, that will increase the public transport from 20 to 40%, that is double. That should be done in near time, before 2030. An enormous investment, an enormous potential for public transport. Bus manufacturers, railway, etc. And railway takes time, unless the Chinese build them, they go faster. But buses can be done more or less immediately. It's very easy to add bus transport. But of course then you have an economic problem, you must create incentives, you must get payment for the bus systems and all that stuff. It is possible to solve, it is a challenge, and we have to do it if we take climate change seriously.
So can you point to examples of technological change revolution that we've done before? And I'm thinking perhaps not of the ones which were spurred by the development of the new technology, like the Industrial Revolution, but ozone's too simple because it was a single change they had to make.
Yeah, but notice, if you listen back to what I've said now, I have basically not talked about big technological revolutions. What I've been talking about now is using technology that basically exists today. So it is, I think it would be a failure to believe that the scientists and engineers at this university should solve the climate change problem. The technology is there already. It isn't only the innovations of the future which should contribute to our transformation. It is also all those innovations we have already done, which are there. Wind power is a well-proven technology. So is photovoltaics. The learning curve is reducing the costs for it. We know we can drive cars, electric cars, a long distance. Not that long as the combustion engine. But then we have all the buses and trains and things like that. So we have, for the coming years, up to 2030 more or less, the low-hanging fruits, we have the technologies. It is a political problem to calibrate the system So it becomes economically and attractive, and politically and socially attractive for people to join this transformation. Transforming should be fun, it should be economically, and it should be rational. And that is, politicians have to help us in that transformation. But we have a lot of the technology. Then, of course, we still continue with our innovative activities. So, continuously we get new solutions. I mean, one solution which is very much discussed all over the electricity world is, of course, the new balancing challenges when you produce sustainable energy instead of this hydropower-based energy. The wind doesn't always blow and the sun isn't always shining. That means we have to find systems to accommodate that in our energy needs.
Or we might have to accept that on a cloudy day with not much wind, then we can't.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of it. Or you can store it in different ways and put off the air conditioner sometimes and things like that. Of course.
So if it's technology that exists today, how come we haven't done it already?
Because the fossil fuels have been so successful, so cheap, so efficient, and partly because we didn't charge the externalities enough. We didn't see them, we didn't want to see them. We are back to the elephant in the room. We have always assumed that externalities is something marginal in solving our economical models instead of this system. This is my basic training and all the basic training of economists, that we may have some externalities, but they are normally so small that we can assume them away, and then we find elegant solutions in the market model. And now we realize that the basic problem is the externalities, and we are very scared of putting a high price. In fact, if we are moving towards extinction, what is the price of carbon dioxide emissions then? Shouldn't it be
very high?
Very, very high.
So why hasn't the market fixed that for us?
That's the general problem with externalities, that those who profit from it don't have the interest. Very many don't see it. As long as you don't see it, you can't have any market reaction on it. When people are starting to see it, you get this kind of reactions. And in fact, I think this is interesting. There is a London-based think tank or consultancy firm called Carbon Tracker Initiative, which some years ago started a discussion on stranded assets. They showed that the market value of many big companies in the world doesn't reflect the fact that these companies have their business models based on continuous burning of fossil coal. So if you take that away, the market value should be totally different. You have a stranded assets. Either that is a consequence of that the financial economists don't know about this thing, or they are not interested because it isn't that fun, or they believe that the politicians will not fix it. But I mean, now the movement now, keep it in the ground movement, saying that you must get a political system that makes it possible to force companies to keep 2/3 of present proven carbon reserves in the ground. They should be kept there. You have about 3,000 gigaton carbon reserves. You can just allow another 1,000 gigaton.
So how would that work? Would people get paid to find oil but not mine it?
You can say it isn't allowed to mine. And you can say that one way is to, you are not allowed to mine any more coal in Poland. you know, this is a tough situation. You can also say that you put so large taxes on it, so it is becomes uneconomical. That's the way I would suggest. But the carbon pricing system in Europe has totally collapsed. We know that. There is no good carbon pricing system in the world, which is enough. So we have a tough challenge. We have a lot to do. And sometimes when I go to sleep, I think this is too tough. But as I know it is possible, I think it's still worth fighting for.
How are we going to finance this 50-50-50 reduction?
Yeah, it depends. You can talk about in the short run and in the long run. You must convince people. We are discussing it in Sweden a lot. In fact, that means you have to find a pricing model and a taxing model which makes it rational for people to transform. In a welfare state like we have in Northern Europe, you also have to think on the tax base. We should go into the details, but of course you can say like this: if you dramatically increase the taxes on carbon dioxide, you get a lot of income to the state, or to the states if you have an agreement in European level. But increase of tax income is that increase of taxation of carbon dioxide is successful, then the tax income will be reduced. And the welfare state sits there without any income. So this is a tricky taxation model. On the one hand, to transform the economy. On the other, to keep the welfare model in the Northern Europe, which is circulating around 40% of gross domestic product channeled through the public system. You don't have to have it like this. You can have the American model. I don't know exactly how it is in your home country, but at least the Northern Europe has roughly 40%. Channel through the public system. So you must have and if you want to keep it this way, you must have a taxation model which on the one hand steers and allocates, and on the other gets money for public funding. That is discussed in Sweden. Of course it is possible to solve, but you must also convince people that this is the right way. That means you can't only increase taxation on carbon. You could talk about green taxation swaps, I would call it, or something. Say that you increase the taxes on carbon dioxide and all greenhouse gas emitting processes, you should reduce it some other way. And then, along the process, when the taxation works, you may have to calibrate the system so you can reach the welfare model you are intending to have. You can agree on 30%. Public funding or system, okay, then you can calibrate towards that target. So it is possible, but this is the tough thing. I mean, I think politicians are the main target here. We have to have strong politicians, not only to listen to how people, that people find problem in this transformation, but convince people we have to go. And this is our suggestion how to do it. And either we are proactive and take the initiative in this transformation, or the transformation will come anyhow because of environmental disasters and extreme weather conditions and all these things. So I think political rhetoric is important, and there are not many political leaders, I think, who have been managed to do it. I think that Obama recently has started, now because he doesn't have to be re-elected. I think the political leaders are very weak in this area. I think, in fact, when Angela Merkel and the Germans declared this Energiewende, I think this was interesting. They really took the command of the situation. We wanted to. You can discuss whether it was the right solution, and maybe I shouldn't have declared it like that. But in fact, they did it. They said, we have to solve this transformation problem, and we are working on it. So from that point of view, I think Angela, the Germans have been showing something. Obama is now, but of course that is the position of the last year of the last period of the president.
who is it that we need to convince? Do we need to convince the politicians that it's a good idea? But are they prisoners to a population that's busy having a party?
Yeah. First of all, I probably meet the wrong people. But the people I meet in industry are all extremely engaged in this transformation. Industry is moving ahead. Many industrial firms in energy and all, we have to do it. We have, and it has to be done fast, and the industry also wants politicians to come out on the scene. But of course, that is partly because I meet I don't meet the representatives for the industry who are the heavy stakeholders in the old regime. Mm-hmm. I have no friends among coal mine CEOs. Okay, so, but the industry is interesting here. Secondly, politicians know this. I mean, I'm engaged in a government commission to the Prime Minister, and of course he sees this, he knows this. He's scared of it because this is the elephant in the room, and he really doesn't see, and they really don't see how to convince the electorate, the people. So I think here it is, a lot of people know it also. But I think both you and I, we are waiting for the politicians to take initiatives here, and then we will follow it. So I think people know more than is up on the open agenda. But you have politicians to, how to say, coordinate it, to mobilize this knowledge. I mean, you have polls showing that people know about climate change, not only in the rich countries. I mean, the people in Bangladesh know what is happening. I think it's but especially now in Northern Europe, it is my impression that many politicians are very scared of the successes for the populist parties which are coming up in all Northern European, more or less all European countries, which may mobilize segments of the people who are hesitant to many things, and also to these things. So I think it's a challenge. I really see them, but politicians are not, of course, they know more than they dare to tell, but they have to tell, to convince, they have political leadership isn't only reflecting what they believe the electorate wants. It's also, it is also to convince people we have to move in that direction.
Is a transformation possible under a system that has policy flux between progressive and conservative governments?
I think, this is my argument also in the book, that climate change puts a real challenge to the classical right-wing, left-wing division in many country politics. That is in Sweden, that is in many other countries. It isn't that easy that the left-wing are green and the right-wing are non-green. It isn't so. I've seen in all over the political spectrum, I see this is a question of. And I think we have to find political alliances in this thing which goes over the very, this kind of left-right division. Now there are countries we don't have this very clear left and right, but in Sweden we have had it now for some decades. We have a red-green coalition on the one hand, and we have a blue coalition on the other hand, and now we have a big populist party which is trying to balance this, which challenges the whole thing. But I think this is the wrong way to. You can't handle climate change within this framework. I mean, historically, social democrats in the left part of the Swedish part has been very hesitant also to climate change things because they have thought that this is a challenge to employment, although I think it could be the other way around. But and you have on the right hand side in the Swedish thing. You have a lot of climate and environmental enthusiasts in many of the political parties there. So
what's the alternative? Are you suggesting a gentle revolution?
I think this will turn up to be necessary within a few years when the climate situation becomes worse. I think also the fact that you have this growing populism in many European countries may also put new dimensions on the political situation in many countries in Europe, including Sweden. But I am not a political expert in this case.
You've got a new book coming out in English, Triple Challenges for Europe.
Yeah.
What are those triple challenges?
One is climate change. The second is we talk about economic development. And the third is governance. And I think we have talked a lot of climate change now. The economic development is, of course, the unemployment situation. You have a situation now that 10% or roughly of European population is unemployed. In some countries, you have 25% of the, on the average, and 50% of the youth, like in Spain, in Greece. We have the Greece situation. You have austerity. You have the failure of austerity politics on the one hand, but you haven't managed to provide an alternative. So you have to, on the one hand, combine the climate change mitigation and adaption with getting out of this austerity politics, trying to solve the unemployment problem. And then, of course, you have the governance situation, which is extremely well shown now during the migration crisis we have now. Although the book went in print just before the present migration situation came, but Europe for the moment doesn't show any potential to have any coherent solution on this. And we have some ideas on that. And basically it is how to combine the end of austerity politics with investments in green solutions and using also, of course, innovation policy, although we declare that the solution is not in new innovations. We have a lot of knowledge already, but we also have to innovate all the time, of course, and there is a large discrepancy between European countries as regards innovation. Sweden and Finland historically have a very high innovation efforts and R&D efforts. Other countries have very low, of course. So this is the basic message, and it will be published now in October.
It's called
on Oxford.
Okay, some questions to finish with then. What is the biggest success you've had in the last few years?
You mean in Sweden, or you mean?
No, for you.
You? In fact, I don't look upon it. I do not look upon what I'm doing now as whether it is a success or a failure. If I look upon my personal view now, I think that I think I have got a synthesis of my very old interest in environment sustainability, which I had already when I was young, in my young 20s. I told you that I became engaged with the Silent Spring thing. Mm-hmm. And I think when I managed also to get some synthesis with looking upon industrial and social change in that direction, it is not a question of individual success. It is a question of getting a coherent view of my own research. So that means also now when I'm retired, I, instead of going deeper and deeper in and asking for more and more and more research money on the details of technical transformation, I have done a lot on pulp and paper industry, things like that, I instead widen my scope and go more into the debate on how to get impact and in work with this transformation. So, and I think this is in, an old professor like me can do that, but I think many younger academics now, they get more and more narrow-minded into more narrow research fields where they try to publish more and more paper to keep up the competition for academic position. So instead of doing that, I try to use my knowledge, getting synthesis, and have and broaden my view into the public debate. In Sweden, we talk about the third task for academics. The first is research, and the second is teaching, and the third is social influence, an impact on industrial society. And I now take the opportunity to have an impact on industrial society of the research I've been doing recently. Whether it is success or not, is not the main task.
You might have just answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Pardon?
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. Not. Maybe I am of the generation when my age, all students in my age were activists when they were young. But basically, I'm an academic. I've been working many years with academic. I've been extremely academic in my research. I wouldn't say I'm an activist, but I would say that I'm not scared for taking a position in relation to the present transformation challenges, which is solidly based on my heavy work as an academic. I'm not scared to argue for what is important. And then comes back to my basic message that if you take climate change seriously, others do that research, you have to do to work with the transformation something similar to what I am discussing in my research and in my books. You can go somewhat different paths, but this is the magnitude of the challenge which has to be solved. And summary of it, 4% decarbonizing every year for the coming rest of the century.
What motivates you? You're supposed to be retired, but you've got a big office here full of books. You're still coming in.
Yeah. You mean what keeps me moving, or two cups of coffee? But no, I think that of course there is. I still think I have a lot to do. And as academics, physically, I have not worked too much, as you realize. So I'm still interested in a broad thing. I think that is one thing. I have a broader interest than is good for being a real top academic. I think I'm too interested in many things. That makes my present top engagement relevant, because I work with both social things and industrial things and can go deep into the technology. That gives me an opportunity to be engaged in the debate. So I write articles in the daily papers and things like that. But they keep me moving. I'm engaged in it. So I have too little time to do what I really want to do.
So what challenges are you looking forward to in the next few years?
I would really appreciate if a Swedish government, irrespective of political color, could agree on a transformation of our carbon dependence, for example, on the 4% target level, and not only get acceptance in Sweden, but also show this is possible, and get followers all over the world, not only in Europe, but also in your home country.
You might have just answered this one, but we'll ask this one as well. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would that be?
I'm sorry to say, I don't believe in miracles.
Okay.
So I don't believe in miracles.
I have a backup for that.
You have a backup for that. And in fact, I would say that, unfortunately, I believe that it will be worse before it becomes better. So I think, I don't think the political agenda will be that positive as I want it to be tomorrow. I think we would still need to have wait 5 years or something. Unfortunately, we will face some other disasters and things, and maybe then we will mobilize a transformation, which will be tougher than it should have been, but unfortunately, I think this is the way it will move. So I don't think Paris will be the start of a new era. It will be, at best, the end of the old.
What's the smallest thing that we could do that would make the biggest possible difference?
You have a lot of difficult questions. The smallest thing we could do... Not the smallest, but as I have put this, all those halving things, and I try to do it myself, instead of trying to be extremely good living, I mean, I can't live in the way we have to do within 30 years. I think it's possible for all of us on an individual level to make the first half of our carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions, either directly or at the worst with some kind of climate compensation then. So then it shows it is possible just to make this half. The rest is very difficult because we live in a different way. Everything around us makes it difficult. But there are enough low-hanging fruits for us as on the individual level to do the first half. I have tried it. I'm not... as most Swedes, I have a car. I run it on ethanol, and you can always discuss that is not a big solution. I have at least, without any problem at all, reduced my car travel to less than half. I use the car, I don't discuss too much about it, but as you say, this very concrete level, I have to do more, and we all have to do more in the future, but on a very short-term individual level, it is possible to reduce with half, with no suffering. And you don't have to talk about it, and you don't have to be proud of it, and you don't have to be a role model for everybody else. It's just you can do it. You can keep some confidence in it, and then you can argue for the other things on a political level.
Okay, last question.
I thought that was the last question.
No, that was the second last question. The last question is, do you have any advice for listeners? Again, you might have just answered this, but it's a free hit to answer something else.
I don't. I think there is enough of advices now and things. I think people can consider this. I don't think we need more out there.
Thank you very much.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Emeritus Professor Stefan Lestadius and KTH in Stockholm. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes and other pod-like places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.